Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. Increased life expectancy around the world is challenging economies, and it's stressing government services, and it's changing the way we live our lives. So joining us to discuss this demographic shift is Joseph Coughlin. He's founder and director of MIT's Age Lab. He's also the author of the book, The Longevity Economy. He's joined by Andrew Scott, Deputy Dean and Professor of Economics at the London Business School. He's the co-author of the book, The 100-Year Life. Moderating this program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. This program is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to Ray Suarez.
Let's talk about one of the world's most interesting good news, bad news, challenging news stories. Between 2015 and 2030, the portion of the world's population that is over 60 will grow from 900 million to 1.4 billion. And by 2050, mid-century, the portion of the world's population over 60 will be 2 billion people. Now, that means there's a lot less early death. That means there's a lot less lingering in bad health that finally stalks you and takes your life at 55 or 61 or 62. But there are challenges embedded in those numbers, aren't there, Andrew?
Absolutely. Although I'm so glad you began with sort of stressing the good news, because this is, in general, a wonderful achievement. There's a lot more people living for longer, and on average, and averages can be very misleading, they're healthier for longer. But there's a lot of challenges. Some are, of course, that although we're living for longer, we will have more ailments and problems. But also, we haven't designed our society for such long periods of life. So we have to think a little bit about how we structure life and how we use this gift of time to make the most of it and to make sure we get the biggest benefit and the smallest costs.
Joseph Coughlin, the United States is actually younger than a lot of the developed world. But even here, the share of the U.S. population that is elderly will double by 2040. Are we ready for it?
No, we're not ready for it. And of course, the irony is that we've known for decades that the loudest and perhaps one of the largest generations, the baby boomers, are turning 71, 72 years old every 7 to 8 seconds. So it's not as if we didn't see this coming for the last 7 decades.
So what did we just figure it would take care of itself? I mean, that's some serious social reengineering that has to happen.
Well, you know, in many ways, not just the boomers, but society in general is reaping what it has sown for many, many years. And that is, old age, as we think about it, is made up. And we've always focused primarily on the youth, whether it's media, whether it's on foods, whether it's on experience. We focused on, shall we say, the 18 to near 30. And frankly, that was good enough. But now that we've got this fastest growing market of older adults, we've never, ever had to re-engineer not just society, but experiences and products and services. And so old age is actually quite new.
Andrew Scott, I've done a lot of reporting in the developing world, and often I've been in a village, a small town somewhere on a farm, and I've been assured by someone talking to me that unlike in the developed world, wherever we are, Africa, Asia, Latin America, really treasures old people. And it was only after a while of people telling me that in the developing world that I thought about it, looked around and saw how few old people there were and realized, well, yeah, it's easy to treasure them when there are so few of them. Is the developing world really ready for this demographic change?
No, I think the answer is the same. I mean, I think you can argue the society is already, certainly at an individual level, making lots of changes. So I think we're seeing already sort of people respond by getting married later, having children later. They've got more times. So they're less of a rush. We're seeing the age at which people get divorced increase. So we're seeing rising divorce rates of people in 60s, 70s, and 80s. We're seeing more people working already. So there is already some of the change happening. But I think if you look at the developing world, they're actually aging more rapidly than the developed countries. So what tends to happen as you get rich is you tend to have fewer children and people live for longer. And the quicker you grow, the faster that change occurs. And given the speed of growth that the emerging markets are seeing, they are actually aging much, much faster than the West. And as you rightly point out, they don't really have the capacity to manage that. So actually, I think that the really big challenge is going to come from the emerging markets in the years ahead.
I think that's one of the moments in this program that's going to leave people listening to it sort of surprised, give them an aha moment, leave them scratching their head, because the assumption is that the developing world has lower life expectancy, that it is less likely that you will live to be very aged in those poorer parts of the world. We're in new territory where large numbers of people actually will get old before a country gets rich. I don't think that's ever happened before.
No, I mean, and of course, in emerging markets, people tend not to live as long as the rich countries. It's just that the gains in life expectancy are actually faster, because just as their GDP is catching up, so too is life expectancy. And then, of course, the other challenge you've got is there's just so many people in that part of the world. So it's already the case that most of the people over 60 are living in emerging markets, because most of the people in the world live in emerging markets. It's just that disproportionately, given how big the population is, there's not as many older people, but that will increasingly change in the years to come.
Joseph Coughlin?
No, and not only do we have to be concerned about whether they will get rich before they get old, but think about the infrastructure that will be necessary to care for an aging population. They will not have the funding. Chances are the access to the technologies that will be vital to being able to care for older adults at a distance, let alone in the same village or town. China, for instance, still very much a developing economy, is really confronted not just with a lower birth rate, but frankly that they are leaving many of the older adults in rural areas so that young people can seek jobs into the city. And many of these countries do not have the social services or the policies in place to provide what might be just a very rudimentary social net.
If China wasn't so big, Joseph Coughlin, I guess we could look at this with interest, but not with alarm. But this is one-fifth of the world's population. What they've done is engineered themselves into a demographic crisis, haven't they, by restricting childbirth and creating kind of an overhang of old people.
Well, you know, perhaps you don't need to hear from someone at MIT what the best birth control is, but the best birth control is education and income. And frankly, even though they have relieved the one-child, one-family policy, the fact of the matter is that people are choosing not to have children, as they are around the world, as well as China. In fact, this is new territory, that we have always had lower fertility rates for disease, for war, for famine, and then right after we've had the proverbial boom. But now we have an entire world around the world, basically people saying, perhaps not. Maybe not because it's too much, it's too difficult, or perhaps we can't afford it, or frankly, it's just too much trouble.
But there's also, I mean, I think, you know, these are all valid points. But of course, as you said at the beginning, there's lots of nuances to this subject. And I think there's sort of two separate things one has to bear in mind. The first is the one we're focusing on, which is with declines in the birth rate and people living for longer, the population skews towards older people. And if our concept of what people are like in old age hasn't changed, or if we can't support them better, that's going to put a lot of pressure on the state and the economy. But the other thing that is happening is that actually we're sort of getting fitter and healthier for longer. The mortality rate is declining. So it's actually interesting. If you look, for instance, at the US and the UK population over the last 40 years, the average age of society has increased, but the average mortality rate of society has declined. So if you look at chronological age, the average person is getting older. If you think about actuarial age and the mortality rate and the risk of dying, actually people are younger. And there are those two different effects. One is that on average, people are healthier and for longer, which is good news. And then the other is there's a change in the distribution of the population towards more older people, which is a challenge.
Well, let me up the ante there just a little bit, because along with, and as you say, you can see it very easily. People are working longer, healthier. But the oldest old is the fastest growing cohort among the worldwide aging. By 2030, it's estimated that 434 million people will be not over 60, but over 80. And those people offer a different set of challenges, don't they, Andrew?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the problems we've got here is that I think the word aging, I find, is ambiguous, has many, many different meanings. And then, of course, not only do people age at very different rates. So, you know, you can be 90 and running a marathon or 40 and in a wheelchair. So age is actually not a great definer of someone's health or capacity. But also because of changes over time, you know, what it means to be old has also shifted. So the question is being over 80, is that the equivalent of being over 70, 30 years ago? So we choose these numbers of having a meaning, but just as in the US, the average age of first marriage is risen from low 20s to high 20s, we're seeing some of these numbers change their meaning. And I think that's the crucial thing. One of the crucial ways we have to adapt is that because we're living longer, we do have a set of new problems, but it's not just about end of life. It's also about all of life. And the question is, how do we reconstruct society, not just to deal with these new problems that are happening with the very old, but also the new challenges that occur right the way through life? Because if a child today does have a life expectancy of 100, then they start work at 20, they're probably working to the late 70s. So it's not just thinking about what people do right at the end, it's also about every stage of life that we have to rethink.
Joseph Coughlin, if you look at the numbers that come out of the United States Social Security system, a lot of people say they intend to work later, declare their intention, for instance, to work until they're 70 so they max out on their Social Security check, but the actuarial tables kept by the Social Security Administration show that only a small fraction actually live out that intention.
But I think part of the problem what we have here is that not only are we having a challenge to define what old age is, we have yet to change the story of what longevity should be. So there are people who are intending to work longer, but we have not re-engineered the workplace to make that physically possible. We talk about working longer, but we still have rampant ageism despite laws on the books that are either poorly enforced or, frankly, policies have not been put in place. We want people to work longer, but we have not rethought the education system so that people are educated throughout a lifetime to be able to make the business case to stay in the workplace. This is truly a societal change that not only needs to redefine what we think age is, but it is a longevity revolution that needs to change our notion of what we expect from people and what institutions and society needs to do to meet the needs of individuals and families and, yes, society as a whole.
But, Joseph, listening to you talk, I can imagine conferences and I can imagine plans and white papers in developing countries, in developed countries, in modern economies, where people look at the numbers, where there are actually many, many jobs that you can do without a great deal of physical challenge. But I wonder if countries that are aging rapidly, like Mongolia, Croatia, Bulgaria, Romania, Brazil, actually have that kind of capacity to re-engineer that you're talking about, and whether they can have the wherewithal to do it while they're still building their economies for people between 20 and 60.
And of course, you know, in the longevity economy, it's not just looking at the aging of the population, it's looking at the entire lifespan. And many of the employers in these developing economies, particularly in Eastern Europe and frankly even in Africa and the like, are major corporations and multinationals. They are now beginning to integrate robotics, cobotics, not just to be more efficient, but to enable somebody who's over 50 to be able to lift those boxes or to stay on the assembly line. So technology, not only longevity, but technology changes not just our expectations, but our capacity that will also reach those developing economies.
Andrew Scott, what Joe's saying sounds perfectly logical, not only logical, but really necessary if the reality of this kind of social change is staring you in the face. But if we look at the example of a country like South Korea, which is aging really fast. Half of elderly South Koreans live in poverty, and this has become a fairly rich country by world standards.
No. I mean, there are, you know, I'd say that the countries who have aged the fastest, which tend to be those who have grown the fastest, do have a challenge because obviously all the institutional changes, the social changes required operate slowly, but the growth has been fast. The great advantage that countries like South Korea have got, though, is that everything's easier when the economy is growing. So countries who are growing at 3, 4% per annum or greater in the case of China, they've got the GDP growth to help pay for some of these challenges. The real problems are countries who haven't got growth and who have got a rapidly aging society. And there's fewer of those. That's a kind of a rare combination. So, you know, there is, as I say, I think scope for some positivity here. The other thing is, you know, I think people forget how much change occurs both through the market, because wages change as you have a shortage of workers, but also as individuals change what they do. So it's not that the system isn't responding. It's not that the system is on a knife edge. And of course, although we talk about aging, you know, if you look at things like technology and Moore's Law, their computing power is doubling every 18 months. We're not seeing life expectancy double every 18 months. So the pace of change is modest enough that though we haven't changed yet, we still have time to make these changes. And I can see already people embarking on these changes. I mean, both Joe and I have had books out recently which have done very well. And I think I'd like to think that's because they're so well written and so interesting. But I think there's just a growing awareness of the changes that are needed. You know, more and more radio shows such as yourself are getting an interest in this topic. So I think people are beginning to be aware. And of course, as the average person in America gets older, as the average person in Britain gets older, they start to think, oh, hold on a minute. The plans I've had that were based around what my parents did or an earlier generation did, they're not going to work for me. I need to do things differently. What do I need to do? Who's out there doing something interesting? So we are, I think, already seeing quite a lot of social innovation and change.
Yeah, and part of the challenge that we're having, and I want to chime in and reinforce what Andrew's saying, the part of the challenge we have around the world, let alone in the UK and the US, and much of the developed world, is we're looking at the aging of society and greater longevity, not as the greatest success of humankind, which I would maintain it is, but as the greatest challenge. I mean, Malthus was wrong hundreds of years ago, and I would say that Malthus's ghost is still haunting us when we look at aging. We need to re-engineer the social contract and the definition of what age is. That means as individuals and families, we need to plan on working longer. We need to stay physically fit so that we can. We need to make sure that we have education to make us last 100 years. On the other side, government, institutions, businesses need to put the social supports in place, ensure that technology is there to support and enable, and to re-engineer infrastructure from transportation to streetscapes to retail experience and everything else. This is not about people aging as we knew them as our grandparents. This is about inventing an entirely new life course for over 100 years.
Let's talk more about that social contract, because right now there's a battle brewing in the United States over how to divvy up a dollar of government revenue. The demands of a very large birth cohort, mine, and I think from the pictures that I've seen of you two guys, yours, is that we're going to put heavy burdens on society in coming decades. If my financial planner is right, and if living to 60 means you have a 1 in 2 chance of living to 90, I'm going to collect some sort of form of social insurance for about 20 plus years. The system was never set up with the expectation that I would be alive to collect it for, let's say, 25 years. And I'm not alone. Are we looking at OAPs in Britain, Social Security recipients in the United States, who are going to put heavy burdens on the system that we really aren't reckoning with yet?
So, I mean, the trouble with this was sort of knowing, you know, quite how negative, quite how positive to be. So one of the things that I particularly dislike but is often used in this sort of conversation is the old age dependency ratio, the number of people aged over 65 relative to the working population. And both because we're living for longer and that very big baby boomer cohort, which, by the way, I'm just 1 year short of, but there we go, is moving through. And clearly it's going to increase the old age dependency ratio. It's a horrible concept, the old age dependency ratio. First of all, I think it misdefines what old age is, given the gains we've had in life expectancy. Secondly, the notion that this group are dependent on everyone else is a strange one, because that group is also, if they are moving into retirement, and of course, more and more people over 65 and over 70 are still working, so they're not retiring. But the other thing I dislike about the old age dependency ratio is this idea that this simple number can be used to predict economic future. And I'm an economist, and I tell you, there's no simple number that predicts the economic future. And if you look at the 20th century, the old age dependency ratio has increased enormously in the US and the UK. And the increases to come are much less than the increases we've had. And we've supported a much bigger increase in the old age dependency ratio through adaptations in the labour force. One of those adaptations has been more and more women coming into the workforce. Now, we can't do that again because there's already a lot of women in the workforce, but more and more women in the workforce required huge social changes, but they happened. And we're going to see a similar thing happening, I think, for the over 50s, where a lot of people between 50 and 65 haven't been working, but we're seeing them work more, and we're seeing more people over 65 work. So, yes, there's going to be some pressure, but I think it's overplayed how big an impact that will have on the economy.
In fact, let's put some other numbers to it. And as I write in the longevity economy, the 60-plus worldwide is the third largest economy in buying power in the world after the GDP of the U.S. and China. And if you want to look at the U.S., the 50-plus control 70% of the disposable income. So while there is great diversity of economic need, there is incredible market potential here to invent new products, new services, new experiences that will grow the economy, not just to meet the needs, which is what we always talk about old age. We talk about needs. But the new generation gap is a new generation of wants and demands from a generation that previously was polite and quiet and waited to be visited. I doubt whether the baby boomers or any generation that follows them are going to be nearly as polite as the parents that they had before them.
Well, there are vanguard nations. There's a cluster of them. Are they doing it better? Are they figuring out some of the things that we're going to have to understand as the community of nations enters more forcefully into this demographic territory? Japan, Italy, Greece, Germany, what are they showing us? What are they modeling that shows us both what the challenges are, but what some of the good ideas are?
So I think, you know, one of the challenges we've got here is that actually we have a simple idea of what old age is and that it creates a fixed set of problems. But actually what we're finding, of course, is as people get older, their health becomes very heterogeneous. And actually, old age is therefore a very bad marker of what people's needs are going to be. And at the same time, over time, we've changed the relationship between age and health. So different countries have whole different sets of problems. I think if I were to think about what Japan has done remarkably well, one is it is a bit of an outlier in terms of the longevity of people. But also it seems to have done very well in terms of getting everyone to live for a long time. Perhaps that may be one of its challenges. The UK and the US, there's this massive inequality in life expectancy. And I think that's one area where a lot needs to be done. And, you know, is that about employment? Is that about education? Or is that about healthcare? But I think if you look at Italy and Japan, they've done that remarkably well. Japan and South Korea, too, have done very well. They've got declining workforces, but they've also been major investors in robotics, as Joe was saying earlier. And it's interesting, they've sort of maintained their productivity all the better because of their investment in robotics. But their challenge is, you said yourself, Ray, is that their growth has been so rapid that their change in their demographic structure is so rapid that they've got an even bigger problem in terms of a generation moving through than the baby boomers.
I look at Italy. Italy has had a low birth rate for some time and has been aging fairly rapidly and is also right now going through a political crisis around immigration, around, to make it plain, the entry of workers at peak youth working age. Is this a mismatch between demographic need, Joseph Coughlin, and politics?
In many ways, it may be, but one of the things that we've seen about in immigration in Europe is in many cases, some of those immigrants do not necessarily stay, but also numbers do not necessarily make skills matches as well. So just because you have people does not necessarily you've put into place the training or, frankly, the technologies in place to be able to leverage those numbers by themselves. So Italy, Germany and the like have seen waves of immigration not necessarily matching the needs, but rather just increasing numbers. So you were looking at what best practices are out there. I have not seen any country, shall we say, comprehensively get it correct. The Scandinavians have done a very good job at redesigning some of their infrastructure to meet the needs of an aging population. The Germans using robotics in factories. On the other hand, the Japanese are leading the way in terms of smart home technologies and caregiving and robotics and the like. So no, there is not one country that is getting it right with immigration or technology or design, because this is entirely new and unprecedented. And frankly, that's the great opportunity, which is to invent a new future of old age.
You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez. I'm joined by Andrew Scott, who's a professor of economics at the London Business School, and Joseph Coughlin, who's the founder and director of the Age Lab at MIT in Massachusetts. And we're talking about the rapid aging of the world's population, some countries doing it more quickly than others, and really a reminder, in case you think this is a fairly grim topic for the rest of the way, it's not. It starts with a great story. It starts with declining infant mortality, rising confidence that the children a family has are going to survive into adulthood, and thus they throttle back on fertility, have fewer children. And this creates age cohorts of different sizes, and in simply mathematical terms, means the average age of a living person inside a country is older, but it does not mean necessarily that something wrong or bad is happening in a society. This is a challenge, a set of challenges, a cluster, you might say, that starts with the great good news of both public health getting better, ministries of health doing a better job, the more rapid dissemination of various kinds of medicine and treatment out to more people on planet Earth, and the likelihood that you will survive past your 20th birthday rising throughout the world. So, you know, a reminder, this is not all lonely old people in lonely, sad little apartments counting the days until they croak. This is a conversation where we're trying to manage our miracles, let's say, and trying to figure out some of the downstream challenges that start with a great, great triumph for the world. But at the same time, there are some realities that come along with, for the first time in anybody's memory, having a lot of old people around all at once.
And part of what your lead in there is giving is the greatest barrier. It's not simply the numbers, but frankly, it is our story of old age, which we have had written over 100+ years. I mean, think about the global industry of economists and policymakers who describe the greatest success of humankind, longevity, in terms of waves and tsunamis and earthquakes in their titles. At the very least, it's a demographic shift. We don't look at this as an opportunity. So really, the challenge is not just addressing the numbers, but it's changing the narrative so that businesses, governments, and families don't see old people, they see longer life and opportunity.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what's really interesting, I think, here is that to go beyond the numbers, and there's an interesting change that happens in the late 19th century when governments start to collect reliable data on birth dates, when people were born, birth certificates. Because then suddenly age as a number becomes very important. And before then, you ask most people, you know, how old they were, they kind of got it to the nearest decade or something. And our concept of being old is based much more around people's functional ability. But then when we had reliable birth records, lots of interesting things start to happen. One is, and there's a wonderful book about US history, birthdays become important. Birthday parties start to become important. We start to make a lot more about the day we were born. Then you start to get the education system that says, right, if you're 5, this happens. If you're 16, this happens. And of course, the most famous made-up age of all is the 65 retirement age. And we sort of developed in the 20th century a three-stage life of education, work, retirement that was based around key numbers that had become the basis of the way in which government thought. But that changed our notion of what it is to be old or what it is to be young. And I think, you know, what we're now finding is, first of all, the numbers we chose don't seem appropriate given the lifespans we've now got. That structure of time, that three-stage life, is no longer appropriate given the time we've got. So just as the 20th century we saw teenagers created and retirement created, we're seeing whole new stages of life being created right now. But as Joe says, we need to move away from this notion of numbers, both in terms of age reflecting something about a person and the numbers of people coming through, and just saying, hey, these are people. And how we define someone as old or not is really about their functional capacity. And that has been transformed.
And in the criticality, Andrew, of language matters. I mean, think about how we think about old age as a vital energy that you're born with. And if you use it, or shall we say misuse it, that is anything that's fun is misusing it, you will get older and fail faster. And the trajectory of how we thought about old age since the 1800s, we had poor or alms homes that transitioned into nursing homes. And at least in the United States, we also had the phrase funeral homes. It was this nice, neat line of how we saw old age.
So from what I hear you gentlemen saying, we're not going to refertility our way out of this. And frankly, we don't have to. So if France is encouraging women to have more children using various kinds of social payment, benefits and welfare, if Scandinavia is trying to encourage women to have more children by supporting them better in the months after childbirth, that isn't really going to move the needle very much. We have the situation we have, and we just have to conceive of it in a different way.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, there are things that can be done. You could try and raise the birth rate, but to be honest, the birth rate is, whilst it responds to economic measures, it's not particularly sensitive. You mentioned immigration earlier, and if you look at the scale of the change, I can't see immigration solving this problem, because we know that high levels of immigration do cause political tensions, and the scale required is too great. So immigration on its own isn't going to do it. The birth rate isn't going to do it. So it's changes elsewhere that'll be done. And that is, I think, you know, where we then capture what is a positive from all of this. On average, we're living for longer. And we're healthier for longer. Now, the problem with this is that averages are very misleading. I always tell my students, you've got one hand in the freezer and one hand in a pot of boiling water. On average, you're doing fine. But that's kind of concealing what's really happening. So the averages are a problem. And we have to allow for the fact that some people are fit and healthy into their 90s, others aren't. And we need to design a system, both policy-wise and through the market, that deals with that heterogeneity and variation, but enables us to tap into the fact that, on average, we're healthier for longer, fitter for longer, and therefore should be more productive for longer. This should be good news for the economy, not bad news. So there is an aging happening everywhere, but of course, the other thing that happens is as the population starts to shrink, the working age population, wages start to rise. And as wages start to rise, people start to invest more in machinery because there's not the cheap workers available. So you actually see greater mechanization. And again, I don't want to be too sort of Panglossian here, but you know, higher wages because there's fewer people to do the roles, so it leads to greater mechanization. And then, of course, we do have this new technology coming along the line, which is getting cheaper and cheaper. And we are talking about the next 20, 30 years, which will also aid to that support for them for the mechanization.
Just as a side note in agriculture, I mean, in the United States, most people would be, I think, very surprised to know that the average American farmer today is over age 60. A very young country, Indonesia, the average age has actually crossed 41 years old. So the agriculture world is already aging, but to Andrew's point, with robotics and cobotics and frankly automated tractors and the like, we're starting to see those areas make it possible for you to work longer. Now, what I wanted to mention before was, again, on language. We don't even know what to call what we currently think of as older people. Are they pensioners? Are they elderly? Are they seniors? We need an entirely new language to, shall we say, have a mind shift, not just a demographic shift, at how we look at this new opportunity.
Yeah, you know, and I get what you guys are saying, and I understand what the numbers are telling us, and I understand the potential and the possibilities. But then I look at my own life, and when my father retired, he had gone to work full-time at 16. And when he was 63, he started taking his Social Security check. And I sat down with him, and I had a long talk with him about trying to squeeze out a couple of more years in order to raise the amount in that check. And he looked at me, and he said, I'm tired. I've been standing on my feet all day, 6 days a week, for 45 years. I'm tired. And my ankles hurt, and my knees hurt, and the idea of working 2 or 3 years more to get a Social Security check that's a little larger just doesn't make any sense to me. And he took the smaller money. He just turned 80, and I don't think he regrets it, but the reality of his life was that this brave new world of working till into your 70s because people are living longer just didn't match his reality.
Part of what we're not thinking about, though, is that people say they want to retire early. Very few of them actually say they want to stop working. They're just not wanting to do what they've been doing for 30 or 40 years. If you look at the sharing economy, the Ubers, the Lyfts, the Airbnbs, we think this is just for kids. And yet the drivers at Uber are very much retirees. The folks that are providing Airbnb, 25% of the folks that are providing those facilities with the highest ratings are older adults. So really what we need to do is to shift the mindset of, no, work longer, not doing the same thing, but you may have many careers over a 100-year life rather than the same job for 70 years.
Andrew Scott?
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that. I think, you know, there's a lot that needs to be done. And, you know, the challenge again with all of this is that people are just very different. And we tend to think about old people being in one box and having one set of characteristics. And I think that's the challenge we've got. So with reference to your father and similar to my father, who started work at 14 and retired at 62 and was tired, he probably didn't have the option that Joe was talking about. Is there something else I can do that is meaningful, keeps me engaged, covers my living costs and doesn't touch my capital, but isn't as intense as what I've been doing. Then, of course, what you've got is a generation later where I didn't leave school at 14. I left school much later. So I started work later. I've got more skills, so I haven't had so much demanding physical work because I'm in sort of less of a tired state. And then, of course, in the workplace, I've got lots of things that can help me more. So there's possible to get more years there. But I think you're absolutely right. That's not everyone. And I think one of the things that does worry me is if we just respond by increasing the retirement age for a group of people who aren't living for longer, who aren't healthier for longer, if we just extend the working career, then they actually are not getting that benefit of longevity.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales. We're hearing from Joseph Coughlin. He's founder and director of MIT's Age Lab. He's also the author of the book, The Longevity Economy. He's joined by Andrew Scott of the London Business School. He's co-author of the book, The 100-Year Life. Moderating this program is Ray Suarez. And now back to Ray.
Because that's one of the changes that's being contemplated. Just simply changing the calibration tables, rising retirement ages at which you qualify for government support, and we're done. And that doesn't get at the granularity, the difference between somebody at 70 who's been working with their hands and working with their back versus somebody who's been only working with their head for most of that time.
Yeah, as I like to say, there's a grand difference between those of us, like the three of us, that get paid by driving a keyboard and running off at the mouth versus those who are actually working for a living as steel workers. I think that public policy needs to be less a meat cleaver and more a surgical device in terms of really thinking about what are the needs, if you will, of various parts of that population.
So, but at scale, when we're talking about generations of millions of people, how do you develop a system that responds to the individual needs created by individual life stories, Joseph Coughlin?
Well, in many ways, it takes time, but we have designed it. We have education that is not perfect, but we have education that gives many different paths from vocational to more scholastic. Healthcare, love it, hate it. Healthcare does try to provide in various countries the level of specificity that individual needs. So the challenge is not that it can't be done, but to get to work, to get into sync. Our education system, our technologies, our employers, and yes, public policy, to put this on the agenda as something that needs to be done, not a problem to be, old age is an opportunity, not as necessarily a problem to be solved, but as a life course to be created.
Andrew Scott?
Yeah, and of course, you know, you gave the example of your father who said, hey, I've got an option. I can work for longer and get a bigger check, but I don't want to. So to some extent, we've already got some flexibility in this system, and I think we'll see more and more on that come in over time. My big worry is, and Joe's picked up on this, you know, if we just try and stretch out that three-stage life to make this longer life work, it's not gonna function well. You know, right now we have an education system that says, right, you finish it at the beginning and it lasts you right the way through. We can't deal with that. We're going to have education at other moments in life. And if you superimpose the sort of the technological change onto longevity, it seems fairly clear to me that we're going to have to take a very serious approach to adult education. We sort of, in the Industrial Revolution, extended education to 16 and 18. I think we have to think hard about how people retrain. And I think that then actually is the key, because there's a sort of very static view of this. We're seeing life expectancy gains over time. We're seeing health expectancy gains over time, even if it's not uniform across all different social groups. But we tend to focus on the current old. But we need to think about the next generation of old and the generation in two steps away, and thinking, how did they actually prepare? And really, you know, with more time, which is what's happening, if you want that time to be healthy and productive and purposeful, you've got to keep investing in every moment in life, in your 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. And we just haven't structured either through government policy, education, the health system, or even the markets, an approach that encourages people to do that. And that has to, I think, be the key approach, thinking about the next stage of life and how I prepare for it. We tend to follow social role models. We tend to look at our parents or people who went before us and say, that's what they did, that's what I'm going to do. But we've got to be much more innovative and create this more forward-looking approach, because how well you age is about what you do throughout all of your life, not just at the end of life.
You know, if I may, let me just give a little bit of arithmetic. It's not just about living a number of decades. To put this in perspective for the listeners, as I write in the longevity economy, you know, from 0 to 21 years old is about 8,000 days. From 21 to what most of us would consider midlife crisis, say late 40s, is about 8,000 days. And from that period to typical retirement age of 65 or thereabouts, 8,000 days. But as Andrew pointed out earlier, the fastest growing part of the population is 85 plus. And guess what? From retirement to that period is another 8,000 days. This is not just about a longer retirement. It's about a new entire life stage that we have yet to invent, let alone imagine.
Yeah. And if I can also just pick up on something there, I mean, one of the numbers that I find very powerful when I talk to people of a certain age is that if you look at life expectancy trends and think about how long people have to work to finance a pension, if you're in your early 40s, you're probably going to have to work to your mid-70s, early to mid-70s. And what that means is you've got more work to come than they've done already. And that's something that no previous generation has ever done before. And I think if you want to sort of be depressing about numbers, that's the hard one. Wow, I'm in my early to mid-40s. I've got more work to come than I've done already. How physically prepared am I for that? How emotionally and educationally prepared am I for that? And so, you know, it is whole new stages of life at every point in time.
But we shouldn't be Pollyanna-ish about this. And even with longer life expectancies, in pretty good health, where it's not suffering to be alive at 78, it's not suffering to be alive at 80, things happen. Weathering happens. The human body, yes, there are spry and productive 80-year-olds, but there are a lot of 80-year-olds who don't hear as well as they used to. They don't see as well as they used to. Their reflexes are such that they can't respond as quickly as they used to. There are certain realities. When you drive out of an underpass or a tunnel into the blinding sunlight, and we do expect older people to drive longer just because of the way we've engineered our lives and how far apart things are from each other, your eyes just adjust more slowly to that sunlight as you emerge from that underpass. And that kind of thing is the kind of thing that causes car crashes. The idea that you can't as easily turn around to see what's behind you causes accidents. We have engineered a life that it's not as easy to be 80 in. I was in Jupiter, Florida, visiting a planned community and waiting at a red light to make a left turn. And one of the most heartbreaking scenes, some older people stranded on a median island, three lanes of moving traffic in each direction. They got halfway across the street when the light changed and the rivers of traffic started gushing forward, and they were stranded in the middle of the street. That kind of thing is going to happen in a lot of places as we make a life where it's easy to be 40 and it's not so easy to be 80.
But Ray, let me take that one on directly, because how I got to aging was through transportation and urban design. Let's take that on as an opportunity, a grand opportunity, not just to make the world a safer, more seamless place for older adults, but frankly, if we can make the streetscape easier for older people, it's easier for everyone. The advent of hearables, where it now is becoming cool to put things in your ears, or designer glasses to be able to see. And frankly, coming out of that tunnel, you need 20 times more light to see as well at age 40 to see as well as you did at age 20. So these are meeting together with an incredible buying power and an expectation not just to live longer, but a demand to live better that is going to drive invention, markets, and frankly make a world that's easier, fun, and convenient for 20-year-olds, but also make it possible for you to be 80 and to be seamlessly safe and mobile at the same time.
Well, maybe that's part of the re-engineering we have to do, Andrew Scott, because we don't think of, for instance, center cities. The Williamsburgs, the hipster enclaves, as great places to be old, but they are, because the grocery store is just down the block from your flat. The place where you socialize is just down the block from that. These dense, walkable places might be places, great places to be old, but we don't assume that that's where people want to be.
Absolutely. And you know, you have my sympathies because you've got two sort of relative optimists here. And, you know, of course, there are problems here. But what we're saying is the problem isn't as bad as we think. And there's lots of things we can do about it. But we have to think about it at every level, individually and socially. And I think, you know, one of the challenges we've got is that we've never had to think so hard about what to do at this stage. So we are therefore haven't got the answers. What I do notice in talking to lots of people is I see lots of people in their sort of 20s and 30s doing things differently. I see people in their 60s and 70s and 80s doing differently. But the world is still very much run by the sort of the 40 and the 50-year-olds who kind of aren't doing everything differently. And they perhaps don't understand enough the needs of what it means to be old because of all the preconceptions. So I think it's going to be an interesting question, which businesses will successfully crack this innovation agenda that Joe talks about? And whether, in fact, it will be a 70-year-old entrepreneur rather than a 40- or 50-year-old entrepreneur. Because, you know, you give the example about building cities. Most of the people responsible for building cities don't think or don't engage with that older age group. But again, we talked earlier about countries that lead the way, and the normal candidates are Scandinavia and Singapore, and Singapore is doing an awful lot in thinking about how to design cities in a way that accommodate older people. And as the average voter gets older too, you can expect designs and policies to adjust to accommodate.
What I would suggest, with some irony, given the fact there are three guys on this discussion, is that indeed the innovator of the future, the face of who will bring innovation to old age, that future is female. That she is already the primary caregiver. She is likely to live longer. In her 30s and 40s as a caregiver, she sees the future of old age and sees the jobs of care, the jobs of living longer, of living independently. And we're seeing that the new women's movement is entrepreneurship. In fact, one of the lead new entrepreneurial groups are women over age 50 that are starting new companies, particularly in the service economy. So the vision of innovation being a hoodie-clad, sneaker-clad Silicon Valley young kid is not so much incorrect, but it is woefully incomplete when it comes to the new longevity economy.
In a place like Japan, where they now have remarkable numbers of people over 90, the big growth for jobs for people over 70 is taking care of the people who are over 90. And Again, with the mechanical assists, with beds that help lift people up, with beds and chairs that help people stand up, with robot assists, where they've gone a long way in Japan toward making this a reality. Yes, in fact, we are responding. But I do want to take a little time out of our discussion to keep in mind the places that are outliers. Every region in the world except Africa is aging rapidly. By the middle of this century, Africa will have the world's largest young working age populations. Is there a dividend for them waiting in the fact that in parts of Africa, the average person, instead of being 36 or 38 or 40, is 15? Those are, yes, currently very poor countries, but is there some demographic dividend waiting down the road for them?
I mean, yes. I mean, you know, again, demography isn't destiny, so there's lots of things Africa can do that can make their fortune even better or even worse. You know, politics and the economy is a complicated mix. But yeah, we know that countries where the majority of the population are of traditional working age tend to grow faster because there's more people working. And then, of course, if the world is short of people of what has traditionally been seen as prime working age, then that's going to lead to a higher wage for that level and a higher demand for the services that are produced by that level. So that will be a positive for African manufacturing, etc. So undoubtedly there are positives from that side. I mean, what I would say is I think if that's if you get the economic policies right, then that's helpful, as China's had the last 30, 40 years. If that's all you've got and you don't get your economic policies right, then the demography isn't going to make the economy work. If you get the economics right, that demography will be an additional boost.
One place that's got a similar giant population to China, but a very different age mix, is India, which will have a much smaller portion of its population over 65 by mid-century. Are there coming workforce problems in China that won't be experienced in India because they have a different age mix?
And part of the challenges that we see here is not just about the numbers, but one of the things we don't think about as much are the skills. So while there may be numbers, the question is, will there be a skills gap in providing the jobs that they need? So for instance, you know, in the United States, the average doctor now is 53 years old because there's not a long line of people behind that. In India, we will have to ask, will they have the skills they need to power that economy in the mid-century when by 2047 worldwide, there will be more people over 60 than there will be children under 15. So simply the numbers help, but the numbers without the appropriate skills for the economy of that day, not necessarily a perfect match.
Just a few years ago, I was sitting with the Minister of Population in Indonesia in a lovely courtyard, and the birds are twittering and the flowering trees are all around us. And he said, he chuckled, patted my knee and said, "We're doing it right. We don't have a China problem. We're growing. We're going to be richer. But because we didn't have a one-child policy, because we encouraged lower fertility but didn't mandate it, more families moved voluntarily to having two or three children from six rather than having one from six. And we're going to be better off for that in the 2030s and 40s. Is he missing something? Or in broad, gross terms, was he right?
Well, to be honest, I think people exaggerate the impact of the one-child policy on China. China's birth rate was falling very sharply before it introduced the one-child policy. Taiwan, which didn't introduce the one-child policy, has had exactly the same fall in the birth rate. What China has done is grown incredibly fast. And there's a very sort of standard path that all countries go through called the demographic transition. As your income rises, your birth rate falls, people live for longer, the average age increases. If you grow incredibly fast, and of course, China has grown phenomenally fast, you know, more than 10% average GDP growth from 40 years, then you go through a very rapid demographic transition. Indonesia didn't do 10%, has gone through a slower transition. Now, what that does mean is that Indonesia and India don't face the prospect that Japan and China have got, which is of a falling population. You know, China is going to see 300-400 million disappear from its population because its birth rate is less than its death rate. Japan, too, is going to see and is already seeing substantial falls in its population. That does create some challenges, as we've talked about. But actually, if you look at sort of income per head, these things have a much smaller effect. It just means your economy is smaller because you've got fewer people. And in some ways, that can also be an advantage. But what Indonesia has lost out on is the very rapid growth. What it's benefited from is it doesn't have that same dramatic need to think about how it takes care of an aging population that China has.
Well, we are coming to the final exchanges in our conversation. I'd like you both to talk to what is mostly an American audience about what it's like, what it's going to be like, what it could be like to be an older person in America in 2040. Let's see, how old will I be? I'll be in my mid-70s in 2040. 43? No, I'll be in my mid-80s. I was never very good at math. I'll be in my mid-80s in 2040. What am I...
But you'll feel like you're in your mid-70s.
Exactly. That's right. Well, hopefully, yes. What do I have to look forward to? What do we all have to look forward to since I was born in the year when more Americans were born than any other birth year until the 21st century? I have a big bunch of brothers and sisters looking ahead to the 2030s and 40s. What's going to change and what are we going to figure out? Because we have to.
So I'll jump in. So we've both been to write a book. I wrote a book called The 100-Year Life with Linda Grattan, which was just saying, you know, all of us are having to think about life in a different way and do things differently, whether we're, you know, teenagers, 30-year-olds, 50-year-olds, 70 or 80-year-olds. So what you can't do is think about what people current in their 80s are doing and then think about yourself in 20-odd years' time. You'll be different. And then one of the ways you'll be different too is there'll be just a lot more of you than there were before. So I think that's the other really important thing. It's not just about you. More and more people are surviving into old age. So that also helps too, because it means there'll be communities and communities adjusting to think more about your needs as well. The other thing I think is that because everyone is sort of pioneers, the people who have sort of lived to 100 before did so sort of out of luck or genes. And they've never had to sort of design a life that lasts for that long. And I think that's the other really big change. We don't yet know how long we're going to live. We know we're living longer than others before. So how do we deal with that uncertainty? And how do we keep investing in our health, our mental facilities, and our friendships to make sure that we are as good as we possibly can be in the 80s? But, you know, there is every prospect that you will be significantly healthier and fitter and more engaged than the current 80-year-olds, and there'll be a lot more of you too, which will transform the society around you.
Joseph Coughlin?
So your question is key to my book, The Longevity Economy. You're going to see a lot more technology in old age, not simply to remind you to take your meds or measure your blood pressure, but actually enabling you perhaps to stay in your home longer, to bring information to you, to make things more convenient. Imagine the following: products and services that are not just for kids anymore, but experiences that include fashion and fun and maybe even friends, bringing it to you as a way of inventing an entirely new life stage. And frankly, you're going to have to experience more work, more education. It is not going to be 20, 30 years of retirement on golf courses and beachfronts and the like. And frankly, one of the things that we don't think about, our lives are organized not just by institutions and birthdays, but by the rituals, the myths, and the stories of how we write about old age. We will see by 2020, 30, 40, all new rituals we hadn't thought about before. So for instance, how many of us have ever attended a downsizing party? Well, they aren't there yet, but imagine starting to create these new opportunities and new things that celebrate people after 60, 70, 80, and 90 to start to add order, happiness, and engagement across the lifespan, not just in one part of your life alone.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Joseph Coughlin. He's founder and director of MIT's Age Lab, and he's joined by Andrew Scott, deputy dean and professor of economics at the London Business School. The program was moderated by my co-host, Ray Suarez. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.